That does something. Once again, I'm Sarah Lacey, founder and editor-in-chief of Pando Daily, and we're joined by Jason and Brad Virchow. I'm not going to read the rest of this. Okay, so hi, guys.
Hi.
Welcome.
How are you?
Good. How are you? You're the darlings of e-commerce.
That's very, very humbling.
And you were a gatecrasher at the last minute.
Yes, I am.
It was originally just Jason, and then you.
I thought you called you a
gatecrasher, gatecrasher, whatever you want to call me. This is a quick start to this one.
But it's appropriate because I think one of the things that's really interesting about you guys' partnership is that, you know, it's obviously a site all around design, as a lot of people know. And, you know, you're sort of the business guy and the CEO, and you're sort of the muse, right?
Yeah, you know, the muse. I've never been called that before. To be quite honest, like, when we were thinking of the idea of fab.com, I said, you know, Bradford and I were trying to think about, we'd launched a previous website. It was called Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Or Fabulous, it was spelled wrong. And it was a
that
social...
That doesn't sound like a good
it was, yeah, it was, yeah, and it was... In 2010, we did it. It was a social network for gay men. It was kind of like a Yelp meets TripAdvisor meets whatever for gay community, like where to go, what to do, who to meet, what to buy, everything. And we did that for about a year, and we tried really hard. We built it, what a lot of people said was a great product, and we just couldn't find an audience for it. Mm-hmm. And when Bradford and I were trying to decide, we decided to shut it down after a year. We basically said, you know, why should we continue working on something we didn't believe in that we couldn't get our friends to use? And we really liked working with each other, but we just couldn't see that business going anywhere.
Was it that your friends weren't using it?
That was exactly it. And it was actually, it was kind of like one of these weird things because, like, we were getting all these rave reviews from people. Like, the graphic design was great. The user experience was great. People said we had better functionality than Foursquare. We had better functionality than Yelp. But we couldn't get any of our friends to use the thing.
Why didn't they want to use it?
You know, it's like there just wasn't demand for it. It was like we were building a great product that there was no market for. And so, you know, I think, you know, we were building something for the gay community at a time when the gay community was becoming more and more mainstream. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the only app that the gay community really uses on its own is Grindr now, which is fine. It's like it's
get off it right now.
So you missed the market.
We missed the market. So we had, you know, it's like a great product in search of a market is not a good place to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? You want to have a great market that you then build a product around. And we got together, and I will get back to the muse thing. We got together and said we could do anything. We enjoyed working with each other. And if we were going to do anything, what would we do? And we drew a little circle on a napkin. We drew, you know, kind of the intersection of, we said the intersection of what we're both the most passionate about and that we felt like we could be the best in the world at, and that was a real big untapped market opportunity is what we would do next. And it took us all of a second to say design. And a lot of that was, you know, I looked over at Bradford and I said, you know, here's a guy who everyone I know wishes that Bradford would help them just find good stuff to bring into their life. Mm-hmm. And I said, I can build a pretty good website. Let me build a website around Bradford and around really kind of helping kind of bring Bradford and his taste and style to the rest of the world. And that was, you know, so that was March of last year.
Uh-huh.
And it's been a hell of a year. I mean, I'll walk through some of the numbers, but it's been crazy.
Okay, we're going to get to those numbers in a second. But I'm curious that, you know, the gay social network, I get that wasn't really solving a problem. But what was your insight that design would solve a problem? I mean, that seems more vague and amorphous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we solved a couple problems or attempting to solve a couple problems. Mm-hmm. And one was, where do people who make things sell their products? And since the collapse of the economy, many people who had small businesses, designers, artists, screen printers, you know, cabinetry makers, whatever, retailers were shutting down. Retailers weren't taking the same orders. They weren't taking risks on newer emerging brands or designers. They were keeping what they knew could sell. Mm-hmm. And so one of the problems we were solving was, you know, how do you get great things that people are still making in front of people who may want to buy them? Mm-hmm. And that's been, I think, one of the most rewarding things over the past year is that, you know, I was just in L.A. today with a jewelry designer and a screen printer, and both of them hired two employees this year because of fab.com, and that's like, it's such a great feeling to say that, you know, creative people are paying their bills and keep their lights on because of what they're selling through our site. Yeah.
But was that a byproduct of the site you wanted to build, or was that part of why you wanted to do this?
I think what we noticed was, so when we first had this idea, we said, you know, duh, we will do design. And part of that was, one, we were most passionate about it, but the second was, we saw that there was no one online presence that was synonymous with design. Mm-hmm. And we saw design as a lifestyle, not like it's not just home products. It's, you know, people buy objects of all price points, all categories based on the design of those products. It could be things that are handmade. It could be things that are mass produced. But ultimately, it's good design. Mm-hmm. And we saw that there was yet no one company online that was synonymous with good design. And we said, well, no one's doing this, but clearly there's thousands and thousands of people out there who are making stuff. And it's not just, you know, people making one-off product. It's people who are making lots and lots of stuff. And as Bradford was saying, you know, they were, you know, we really figured out that if we brought the demand, there was plenty of supply. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the aha moment was like, you know, when we said, all right, well, we can build a marketplace around this. And we can build a place where people come to say, fab is design. And the ingredients that we kind of dreamt up at the time was, and I think this is where what we brought together was that no one else had done before, was a few kind of special ingredients we brought together. One is we said, if it's going to be about design, it has to be the most amazing kind of designed experience that anyone had ever seen in terms of a website. So we didn't think e-commerce in terms of build a store. Mm-hmm. We thought, you know, we've got to build an amazing design experience. And so we always said that our design is the website and the apps and the service that we provide every day. That's what we design. And then our designers design products. And we had to kind of have our stuff that we build be up to on par with the products that we're selling on our site. Mm-hmm. The second thing is we said that, you know, a lot of the way people discover product is through their friends. It's social. It's, you know, browsing, window shopping, through recommendations. We wanted to really bring that experience and create that online like no one had ever done before. And the third thing we said is it's got to be mobile. Mm-hmm. That we really felt like one thing that e-commerce really had kind of failed to figure out so far was just how to grasp the mobile experience of browsing and shopping. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big aha moments we had when we were kind of putting all these thoughts together was, you know, if you look at e-commerce 1.0, which is, say, like the first, I don't know, 12 years, 13 years of the Internet, basically Amazon.com won that, mm-hmm. right? And what Amazon.com did is they basically brought the catalog online, but Amazon.com is not what I would call, it's not a store. Amazon.com is the world's best logistics company, mm-hmm. right? And kudos to them, it's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. If you know exactly what you're looking for, Amazon.com is the best place to buy it because they solved the problem of get things to people the cheapest and fastest way possible. But most people, when they shop, don't always know exactly what they're looking for. Mm-hmm. And we thought an interesting problem to solve for is how do you help people browse and discover, get excited by great product every day? And that's what design is all about.
Mm-hmm. But what about the scale issue? I mean, I go on Fab, you know, a couple times a week. And
that's it?
Sorry. I'm a startup. I don't have very much money to spend on designing things. I did find my husband's Father's Day gift.
Really?
On
love
there.
That.
Yeah, and what? I don't think he's listening, so I could tell you
what it is.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's an old record nerd, and it was the that record system that you play records and plug it into the USB. Yep. I'm not describing it well.
No,
is it
right.
as awesome as
yep.
it looks in the
yep.
thing?
Yep.
You
yes.
think he'll like it?
Yep.
Okay, good.
How many things have you bought on Fab?
Very few.
Six, I bet.
I'd say four.
Four? The yeah. typical, so in the last 9 months, mm-hmm. the typical person who's bought two times has gone on to buy six.
Wow. Yeah. So I'm an outlier.
Well,
why is that? So why, but only six? I mean, you don't have people who are buying
stuff. This is like on the average.
Okay.
Right? So once someone gets a two, uh-huh. within 6 to 9 months, they get to six,
uh-huh.
which is really good.
Is there a range of things that they're buying?
Oh, yeah. And we also, so we call it everyday design, mm-hmm. and we call it everyday design because we really want, we always said from the beginning that we want people to just think design, think fab. We want them to think discovering great products, think fab. And that was going to take a long time, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a journey of building a brand. Mm-hmm. You know, we say our job every day is to make people smile. And if we make people smile every day, you know, we'll make lots of money over time. But we really make all of our buying decisions and all of our company decisions around, is it going to make someone smile? Mm-hmm. And you know, what we look at is the journey we take a customer on is everyday design is about not just when you're buying a big ticket item, so you're looking for a new bed or, you know, a new dresser or something like that. It's having something that people can want to come back to Fab every day or a couple times a week like yourself and just say, I want to see what's on Fab today.
Right.
And be able to pick something up where it's, you know, whether it's $20 or $50 or $100, that there's something for everyone. And it's, again, design is a lifestyle that it's not just about precious objects. It's about kind of the everyday things in your life.
Mm-hmm. But back to the issue of scale, I mean, there's a couple questions of scale. I think the first is, and let's get back to talking about you being the muse. So one thing I love about you guys...
You can talk about that all night.
One thing that I love about you guys, I mean, I'm in the media business, and I feel that you're very kindred spirit because you don't view your site based on algorithms. You don't view it based on math. It's a curated product, and it's like you put a product on there if you love the product and think it's a great product, not because there's some metric behind it of how much it'll sell. But how does that scale as you guys get bigger?
Well, I think it scales in a sense that, you know, not everything that we put on the site is something that's one of a kind, made by hand, truly precious, can't be mass produced. The merchandising strategy is this: put enough unique things into the mix that are wow, I've never seen this before, wow. There's jellyfish aquariums on the site today, which, you know, that's not for everybody. But when it's next to, you know, the perfect kind of perfectly priced bed sheets, or, you know, an injection molded plastic chair that's, you know, made in the thousands, you know, the scale is there in many of the products, and the charm and the allure of the site is there in many of the other products. You know, you can't have one without the other, and that's what any good kind of brick and mortar retailer or merchant will do. They will take a store and they'll fill it with things that they know they're going to make a lot of money with, and then they will also accent the store with these truly beautiful found objects, whatever it is, depending on the store. And that's what was missing, I think, from Jason talks about Amazon and e-commerce. I don't come from the technology world. I come from the retailing world. And, you know, what I've always struggled with shopping online is that it's not fun. There's nothing special about it. It's boring. It's devoid of color. It's devoid of personality. It's just, you know, the creative people and designers and artists and the like don't shop that way. But I think a lot of people do. But what we're trying to do is say, hey, everyone can, like, you know, have a little bit more fun in their life. And that's the core essence of the merchandising strategy is, you know, how do you take the things that that there's a lot of in the world that are really great and give them to more people. Charles and Raheem said, you know, get the best to the most for the least. You know, we're delivering on that promise, I think. But then also find, like, a guy that makes taxidermied animal heads out of yarn that are one of a kind, and we may have 13, and we're not going to make any money off of that. But
it's okay.
It'll make you come back the next time because it's not just cups and sheets and...
But I think this really points out, like, a big difference to our approach to our business is, you know, we've from the very beginning taken a very long-term view, and we've said that, you know, we will succeed or fail based on our ability to build an emotional kind of relationship with our customer, and we're going to build a brand that we say internally we're building a brand for the decades, and we're looking at 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 30 years from now. We want people to think design, think fab, and you don't get there by doing what a lot of people have done with online businesses and look at the profit maximization of every single pixel on the screen. You get there by figuring out how do you just get people to be excited and build that emotional response and reaction to them. And we really, I mean, it's not just marketing speak. We believe this stuff, that if we make people smile every day, we will make lots of money over time. It's okay. You know, we have 5 million members on FAB today. We started a year ago. June 9th was when we opened our doors. All right. So, you know, from a standing start to 5 million members, with over 50% of them coming from social sharing, you couldn't do that if you tried to, right? I mean, there's frankly, as far as I know, there's only one other website in the last year that's grown as quickly as FAB, which is Pinterest, right? But they're not a store, right? We're a store. E-commerce companies don't grow like that. It happens because people love the products. It's not because, you know, it's not because we've done anything to try to, like, juice it up or anything. It's like it's authentic. It's because we just focus every day on handwoven taxidermy. That is that what it is, or whatever it
yarn,
is, right? That yarn, or whatever it is. That hopefully someone's going to come to see that and check that out and buy something else. And if they don't, it's okay too, because we'll figure out what excites them the next
time. We have 36 designers and or brands featured on FAB each day, with an average of probably 20 to 30 SKUs per brand on each day. So there's, you know, nearly 10,000 SKUs alive on the site at any given moment. And we are booked solid in terms of the schedule, in terms of how they appear through almost to August now. So that's how fierce the competition is for people to just sell their product on FAB. So the idea of, you know, it's been a common question. It's the one that's from day one before when we were raising money the first time. You know, everyone's like, well, you know, what about the products? How do you scale that? That's not the issue. There are so many people making things that don't have places to sell them right
but
now.
But do you hand approve each one? Because that's sort of what I meant
I
with scale.
I used to.
You have sub Bradfords.
No, of course now. Yes, there's a lot of them.
We lots
there's
of little army. Bradfords running around.
Their shoes aren't as good, but yeah. You know, one thing that you know, this is I think again one of the core things of what Fab's all about. We don't take design and put it in a box and say it's the special thing. And we don't talk to people, our customers, by saying, you need this in your life. We just say, this is cool. They make the decision whether they want it in their life. And so having that, like, we're not Anna Wintour. We're not dictating style. We're just uncovering things that make us laugh, smile, things that we like, and letting people play with that. Mm-hmm. The same philosophy is true in hiring in the buying team. You know, I don't know the food industry. I'm not a foodie. I don't know anything about kids. I'm never going to have a... I just said own a kid. I'm never going to own a kid or have a kid or whatever. Word. Buy a kid.
And I'm never going to buy a kid on the black
and
market.
And a big secret. I don't like dogs. Jason loves his dog. I don't like them. I'm allergic to them. So we
Are
sell
you
pets,
human?
But we sell,
you're a robot.
I am. But we sell pet stuff. We sell kid stuff. We sell food. Mm-hmm. And these are three things that, you know, we had to go out and hire experts. Now, if I see something that I absolutely hate, I say, get it all, you know, this isn't going to make it on the site, but it's
You see it all before it goes on. Do you ever see something on the site and say, oh my God, what the...
No, we have a lot of checks and balances put in place before it goes on
so
the site.
So you see every single thing before it goes on there.
I know at least every brand that goes on.
Yeah. We have a lot of mini Bradfords right now.
There's a lot,
now.
Though. But I built a layer of trust in the buying organization of people that, one, they know what I'm looking for, which is a good thing. But the bigger kind of aha moment over the last year is that they've informed my decision. Like I've expanded kind of what I think is good design or product that I may not have looked at the first time around because you know what we say when in the buying meetings, whether I'm present, which I'm usually there once a week, we do two a week, or the buying manager, the two buying managers that report under her, you know what they're there to say is convince me that you love it. Mm-hmm. If there's any question about it. Mm-hmm. And if someone on our team can passionately say, I love this thing, and it could be as simple as, it's a really simple cup at a really great price. Mm-hmm. Like that, or it could be, you know, this is yarn taxidermy, and they only have 7 pieces of it, and it costs, you know, we're not going to make any money, but I love it, it has to go on the site. But, you know, they have to, the buyer who puts it on the board, we have a giant board, has to be in love with it or at least see the value that it could bring to someone's life.
We definitely have a point of view, and I think the first scrub of the point of view is in the people we hire.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, at this time last year, we had about 15 full-time employees in New York. We have about 400 people worldwide right now.
Wow.
And Bradford and I have interviewed every person we've hired.
Wow. But that can't scale. I mean, every CEO talks about that time when suddenly they don't know the people. They meet them in the elevator
after
they're hired.
There's definitely people, and I'm sorry if you're listening.
I don't know their names.
I don't know some of their names, but I've interviewed every single one of them.
Yeah.
And we definitely, you know, Bradford and I, we say no to somewhere between 15 to 20% of the people that we meet for interviews. And you know, we take the approach of our teams are interviewing for kind of skills, and we're interviewing for do we want this person to be part of our family?
Mm-hmm.
But also part of your interviewing, especially when it comes to, say, the merchandising team, is we're interviewing for do they share our point of view, and will they be able to go out and find stuff that people will get excited by? And again, we care more about they find stuff that excites people than the profit margin of the product. And we have hardly any traditional buyers on our team.
Mm-hmm.
Most people come from more of a retail sales background or just the passion for fab background. Is really like you know, people that come from all walks of life.
Many of the buyers are actually people who make things too. So it's people that kind of can relate to the story of, you know, I've made things, I've sold things, I'm a creative person.
Yeah. But if someone joining fab at this point, they know what our point of view is. Yeah. So no one's going to come in and try to... You know,
sell beige.
Yeah,
they're not going to throw pillows.
Like, people aren't joining Fab's team to try to change our point of view, right?
Uh-huh.
They're trying to kind of bring their kind of what they bring
right.
to our point of view.
There's a lot of people though who think they have good taste but don't.
This is true.
So how do you? I mean, someone could come in and say,
"Oh, what?
I love taxidermy, but it doesn't."
But that's the great thing, though. It's like you know, my whole life. There's a lot of people that still don't think I have great taste, and that's just the reality of it. Yeah, but what good taste is? It's subjective. we definitely have a clear point of view. We may not have good taste, but we have a clear point of view, and that's color, that's humor, that's, you know, a little irreverence. It's graphic. Mm-hmm. It is modern. I mean, these are all kind of words that you could label the assortment of fab.
But that's at least, we don't consider ourselves tastemakers.
No.
We consider ourselves finding stuff that we love. Mm-hmm. And that's scaled now to hundreds of people finding stuff that they think other people are going to love. But it's not that we're trying to dictate taste, which is a very different thing.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because I think...
I'm going to say one other thing. It's like,
go ahead.
We're just bringing a lot of fun to e-commerce, mm-hmm. whereas everyone takes themselves so seriously. Mm-hmm. And it's like we're just selling stuff. Right? And so it's like, you know,
it's not rocket science.
Right?
It's furniture. It's a goddamn chair. I mean, and I think that lightheartedness is what's attracted great people to come work for us. It's attracted awesome investors, mm-hmm. And it's attracted designers and brands that maybe were a little hesitant about our business model. Some of these brands, the Italian brands especially, are still uncomfortable even selling on online, period. Mm-hmm. They don't even have their own, you know, direct e-commerce stores on their websites. And these are, you know, billion-dollar brands, some of them. And so in coming at it at a different angle, you know, we don't take ourselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. We have fun. Our goal is to be the most fun person for these brands to work with, that they have to deal with all the other buyers from every other parts of the world. And that kind of energy and attitude of just, hey, you know what? If you don't want to sell on fab, it's okay.
It's okay. There's no pressure.
It's no big deal. We're selling jellyfish and chairs. I mean,
but there's fun. There's a time and place for fun. And there's another very, very fun modern pseudo e-commerce company, which was Groupon. Everyone thought Andrew Mason was a hilarious guy until he went public.
Totally different.
Yeah,
totally
but Group, different. From day one, the brands that partner with us make money. Mm-hmm. And the motivating factor of someone that's shopping on Groupon is price. The motivating factor of fab.com is discovery. They're two separate beasts. And yeah, if you want to get your eyebrows waxed, fine.
You probably
yeah, I need that done too. It's saving $15 may be a big deal, but like when you're buying like a piece of art to put in your home, you know, $15. $10, whatever. It's like, do I love it? Is the question. It's not, can I get a good deal on it? Mm-hmm. We used to talk about this. We would always bring up my grandmother whenever people would talk about Groupon, because my grandmother, our whole life growing up, we were not loyal to any toothpaste brand. We bought whatever toothpaste was on sale that week, mm-hmm. and that's Groupon. Mm-hmm. It's like there's no loyalty. But like when it's the things, the jewelry, clothing, art, the things that you put in your home, the things that you live with in a very intimate level, I think more and more people want to have a different kind of connection to those items than just, was it the cheapest thing?
Mm-hmm. How do you view yourself in the rest of the e-commerce landscape? I mean, you have this whole trend of stuff in a box. Mm-hmm. I used to call the 5th of every month Brian Lee Christmas because I would get shoes and diapers. You have, and everyone in Southern California is now doing that, and the people who started it are now getting away from it. There's that trend. There's flash sales. Again, everyone did it, and now people are pulling away from it. Were these innovations or these gimmicks?
I think that, again, going back to Amazon being e-commerce 1.0, that there was a realization over the last few years that there could be more to e-commerce and shopping online than just bringing the catalog online. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of companies out there that are creating all sorts of interesting and innovative ways to try to improve the discovery process and the shopping process. And I think we're at the very, very beginning of that. Mm-hmm. And we believe that, by combining certain elements, taste, social, mobile, you know, really good operations, as well as just kind of focusing on the long-term relationship with the customer, mm-hmm. that we can be a significant player in that. But, again, we're at the very beginning of it. And, you know, I start off by saying we're, you know, just humbled to do this because it's been a year, and, like, you look at as much as we've accomplished, but it's the very beginning of something. And we do have fun, but we take the business of having fun very seriously. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of responsibility to our employees and to our shareholders and to our customers and our partners to show them that this is a long-term relationship. And I think one of the mistakes that, you know, that we look at as founders that, unfortunately, I think a few companies did over the last few years is they took growing really fast at the expense of their customers to be a way to build a business, and that doesn't get you the long-term goal.
What do you mean?
You know, I think it's just, you know, companies that the goal was growth and getting public versus and, you know, not honoring necessarily the relationship with the partners or the customers or you know, and versus figuring out, you know, if you're going to really have, you know, once you break that trust with your customers, it's very hard to win it back.
Mm-hmm. Right? And same with the brands.
That they, exactly.
Your business or your restaurants or your eyebrow wax or whatever it is. Once they lose money and they're like, why the fuck would I, can I say that?
Excuse me. You already did.
Sorry. Oh, sorry. Hillary Clinton didn't say that on the stage.
She probably did.
I'll say it before long, too.
Let me take where you left off.
You know,
this is why they don't book me for these things.
So I have to say, so we do these monthly events, and this month we have Ben Horowitz. And between me and Ben Horowitz, like, they're literally going to be just F-bombs all over
he's
the place.
He's an investor.
Okay. Yes.
Right. Well, you guys must get along with your bad mouths. You know, his daughter interns for us, and it gives me hope because all I do is swear in front of my baby all the time. And I don't think it's going to change, frankly, when he gets older. And Sophia Horowitz grew up very well adjusted.
Okay.
She doesn't have a bad mouth. She grew up listening to it, so...
But you got.
But you'll never own children.
No.
Sorry, Jason. Children, you were going to make an actual point.
It's like, I think, you know, look at the brands that we love and trust. I mean, they get built up over a very long period of repeated interactions. And, you know, why do people flock to Apple? Because Apple consistently turns out great products, and they're consistent with their messaging, and they don't. It's authentic, and they don't break the trust of the customer. And mm-hmm. you know, we have that sort of aspiration. You know, we've said with Fab is, you know, we have IKEA scale ambitions. IKEA is a $30 billion business operating in 50 different countries. The U.S. is 11% of their sales. That's the scale that we're considering with Fab. So we're not just dickering around on the edges here. I mean, we're really thinking about how do we build a real business for the decades.
Mm-hmm. And we don't get distracted by these other e-commerce companies. I don't even know what the half of them are. Like, it's like we look at the companies that we read about and are interested in are Target and IKEA and Herman Miller and Apple. These like companies that have built these brands that people know what they are and trust and respect them, and they're doing something innovative and they're focused on design. These flash in a pan kind of e-commerce players are not the people we're modeling our business. We're not saying, oh, they're doing this, we need to do that now. Actually, I don't even subscribe to them anymore. At first, I did just kind of see what was going on, and it just became clutter. And I'm like, we're laser focused on just doing what we do, and don't let what anybody else does, you know, kind of influence what we do.
Fab will do somewhere between 110 and 150 million in sales this year. Mm-hmm. That's our first full year. Okay, mm-hmm. And I literally told our team the other day, I don't care. I don't care if we end up doing 100 or doing 200 this year. It really doesn't matter. What matters is where we'll be 10 years from now. And we'll get there by making people smile every day and just focusing on that. And I don't want anyone making decisions in the company based on how much revenue or how much margin right now. I want them making decisions based on, you know, is it the right content? Is it the right product we want to put in front of people? And do we treat our customers right?
But that's easy to say, but it's very hard to do. I mean, are your investors ever pushing back on that? Is your team ever pushing back on that?
Everyone is bought into it. That's part of the Fab religion. Mm-hmm. And it's part of having a long-term view. And we're lucky. So I would say lucky is the right word. We're fortunate to have investors who believe that vision is the right way to build a business for the long term. And if you look at, you know, a company that we admire, you know, Facebook did that. You know, Facebook for many, many years just said, we're going to focus on the user. And they've managed, even through some stumbles, to always correct themselves and always make sure they do right by the users. And that's why they have, you know, the world's population, basically, you know, using them as the social network. Mm-hmm. And that happens by getting it right over the long term.
Mm-hmm. So do you think this company could have been built in Silicon Valley?
I don't think so. I'll say I don't think so. I think that there's a reason why we were founded in New York. I think there's a different type of creative energy in New York than in Silicon Valley. Both Silicon Valley and New York are creative, but I think they're differently creative. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you...
Yeah, I mean, I think that New York is a design city. And, you know, Tokyo, Paris, Milan, Berlin, and London are the mm-hmm. others. And You know, it's a lot easier to get to those places from New York than it is from California. And so we were lucky. I don't think that it could not be created here, but I think it was much easier for us to the design press is in New York. The designers who live in America really are in New York. And, you know, the designers who come from other parts of the world come and show their products, sell their products, mm-hmm. participate in New York Design Week. So, you know, it was all in our backyard, kind of the brands that we ended up selling.
But culturally, I mean, the last time we got together, you told me a great story about some tech guy who was coming in and interviewing, and they were like, oh, well, this is all the things I would do with your front page. And you were like,
oh, yeah. Well, it's, again, you know, we are a technology company in the sense that, you know, we build all of our own technology. We definitely innovate in, you know, lots of areas, browsability, social, mobile. But we don't make decisions based on profit maximization. We make decisions based on emotions backed up by data. Mm-hmm. And so we always lead with the emotions first, taste, do we love the product, will it make people smile, and then we measure everything like crazy to make sure that we're making the right gut choices, but we lead with our gut.
Mm-hmm. But we are kind of the odd man out. We don't really fit into the tech world because we're like a commerce, we're a store, and we don't really fit into the kind of the design world because we're this website and we're a technology company. We don't really fit into the retail world. And so we kind of do our own thing. And, you know, it kind of hit me on the head when we were at the Webbies and we were sitting there and it was me and Jason and the two founders of Instagram and Bjork. And I'm like, and that two was in lined up in a row. And I was like, you know, this kind of makes sense that, you know, that the three of us are here and, like, actually, for some reason there's a parallel between all of us.
I got to say, the coolest moment for me, actually, is of the last year, one of the coolest moments was, I mean, there's been a lot, but I turned to Kevin Systrom from Instagram and I said, you guys are awesome. I love your product. And he turned back and he said, we love your product.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's pretty cool for, like, like Instagram's huge. Uh-huh. Where are these guys selling stuff every day?
But Bjork, she couldn't be bothered with either of us. So like
just
Kevin,
Swan and
Kevin's the tall one.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a tall one at Instagram
yes.
and a not so tall one. So
tall
the
one.
Tall one.
You
like,
know your employee's name. You know the Instagram founder.
I know Bjork's name. And Bjork had a pile of, you know,
feathers.
Yarn on her head. Yarn.
Taxidermy.
No, it wasn't taxidermy. It was on her head and it was yarn. And like, you know, she's just sitting there like this. Sorry, radio, you can't see that. And he, like, kindly said, I'm sorry, I'm so tall, I hope you can see it. And she just... And it was kind of like, oh, Bjork couldn't be bothered with us. It was kind of sad. Because I really wanted to meet her, but it didn't happen.
We would sell Bjork on that.
Yeah, we would sell Bjork on that. We'd sell her hair.
What about the swan dress?
Yeah.
I'd wear that here if I had it.
Someone get me a swan dress. All right, we're getting low on time. We have about 7 minutes left. So towards the end of that, people will ask some questions. So if you think of a question, you want to ask it, line up at the microphone. Last
everyone
thing I want to make
sure.
Everyone
shout them at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. No. I want to talk about someone that the three of us on the stage respect very deeply, and that's the Salmer brothers.
Yes.
for those people who don't know, there are, you know, always people who copy businesses and take inspiration from businesses. I mean, Facebook was certainly not the first social network. Google was certainly not the first search engine.
And Lady Gaga was definitely not the first blonde pop star.
Exactly. Yes. And then there's the Salmer brothers who just...
That joke, the bombs.
Sorry, I thought you were just making a point. I didn't know I was supposed to laugh.
No one else did either.
The Salmer brothers are these just shameless German copycats that Andrew Mason decided to make incredibly rich. And so now they just go around actually stealing colored palettes, stealing yeah. code, making up fraudulent deals, and people, companies get intimidated by them because they basically say, if you don't buy us, we're going to rip off everything you do. Exactly. We're going to do it in Europe, and then you won't be able to expand to Europe.
You
we'll
seem
take
to really
the market.
Like them.
I love them. It's why I'm in this business, to cover entrepreneurs like them. So you were probably the first I know of, entrepreneur who came out and went after them when yeah. they did it to your yeah. business. Everyone else is really quiet. They don't want to ruffle feathers, or they buy them. They placate them. You came out and called them out.
Yeah, I would say, you know, we are fab. We do something that's unique. Our business is very hard to replicate because it's a unique combination of taste and technology and people that we pulled around this whole kind of concept. And So I'll tell you the way this happened. So in October of last year, we looked at how far we had grown so quickly. We basically hit 1 million members in the first 4 or 5 months. Sales were going really well. We felt like we'd build a good team. And we started to think about what does international look like for FAP? Should we go sooner versus later or not? And Jeff Jordan, who from Andreessen Horowitz on our board, he's on the board of Airbnb. He's on the board of Pinterest, both of whom were copied by the Sommer brothers. Mm-hmm. And Jeff said, you got to think about this earlier versus later, especially with a business like yours that is somewhat unique and growing so fast. They're going to come in and clone you guys. And what we decided at the time, I was actually at that time, I was like, whoa, we just got started in the U.S. We're really going to think international so quickly. But we looked out and said, we didn't want to cede anywhere in the world to anyone. Mm-hmm. And we started to explore if we were to go into Europe, how we would do it and all that sort of stuff. And what does the rest of the world look like? And just started to kind of get smart about it. In January of this year, the Sommer brothers launched a site called Bamarang in 12 countries. Simultaneously, which was a direct copycat of FAB. It actually was our exact graphic design. They even had job postings that they had basically copied and pasted from our site. There was images, including images of our employees and some of the... it was shameless.
Our pictures were on the site.
Right. And exact copy of... And literally, and it was just shameless. And I looked at this and I was like, we're all about good design. Mm-hmm. You can't copy good design. And so what I did at the time was I wrote a blog post about, welcome to the party, but you can't copy good design. And people are going to see right through this. It has to be authentic. Mm-hmm. We work with designers every day. And, a designer, the last thing they want is someone, kind of copying their product. Mm-hmm. And it kind of went sort of viral. I mean, people picked up on it. They saw it, and they kind of got to, agree with it. Our designers saw it, and they said, we're not going to do business with these guys.
Mm-hmm. But they found a way around that.
Well, they're very innovative, these guys. What they did is they went out and just, bought product from distributors and from retail to sell
on their
site.
They bought it off of the retail.
Yeah,
right. So they wouldn't do business with them. They went in and bought 50 things off the shelf and put it on their site.
And so basically,
and
set,
a loss. The designers were.
Yeah, exactly. And so they bought all the product without permission. What we went and did is we said, look, we're not going to be one of these companies who allow ourselves to be copycatted. We're not going to be a business that looks back a year or two later and says, gosh, I really wish we would have gone to Europe faster. Now we have to buy these guys. The last thing we were going to do was going to put a dollar or a euro in their pocket. Mm-hmm. Right? And so what we did is we launched our own version of FAB in Europe. We went and looked at 6 different companies that were doing things similar to FAB in Germany. We found one that we thought was just a phenomenal team that was off to a good start. They really got the spirit of FAB as well as how to build a business like this. We acquired them. Basically, that deal closed in February. Mm-hmm. And so to put in perspective, fast forward the story is 3 days ago, the Sommer brothers basically declared that they're shutting down Bamarang. Mm-hmm. And they're shutting down Bamarang because we beat them in the marketplace, which is awesome, right? Mm-hmm. The customers voted. The suppliers voted. Suppliers wouldn't do business with them. The customers said, that they were, they wanted to be with FAB. We had a better product than them. We have over 1 million members in FAB Europe right now. We're selling in 18 different countries in Europe. We have, we're basically on a run right now about 1.5 million euro per month. Mm-hmm. The Bamarang at their best was doing 100,000 a week, mm-hmm. and they got to 200,000 members max across 12 countries, mm-hmm. including Brazil, India, Turkey,
Australia,
etc. And it's because you can't fake it. You can fake certain businesses, but this has to be real. Like stuff that Bradford talked about in terms of the types of products we select to be on FAB, that's very hard to replicate. Mm-hmm. And when we talk to people who worked at Bamarang who have come to us ask if we would hire them.
Will you hire anyone who came from there?
It's hard for us. It's hard for us. It's like, I think if someone was a...
For the radio guests, Bradford is wincing. Yeah.
I think if we felt like they had a good... We've had a couple people who have approached us who we actually think have good merchandising taste, but they weren't allowed to flourish inside of Bamarang because Bamarang is more focused on just being a machine, a factory, kind of Sommer style. And I think we would potentially entertain one of those people, but it'd be very hard for us to reward people who felt like copycatting was a good business practice. Mm-hmm. So the people on the business side, mm-hmm. very tough for us to kind of say hello to that.
So was it just the design reason they lost, Or do you think they're going to start losing on other fronts? Like, what about Pinspire, their Pinterest clone? I mean, what about some of the others? Do you think their time is over? People are calling them out?
I think that copycat businesses can succeed when it is just about kind of, you know, low-cost customer acquisition for a one-time transaction, right? But I think it's very hard for that, a business like that to succeed when it's about building a customer relationship for a lifetime. I think, now, I do know a couple of their businesses that are doing well, and I think it's somehow they've managed to build teams who have gotten past that point of just the one-time transaction. They have a business, Glossybox, which is the Birchbox of Europe, which is doing phenomenally well. And it's probably that they just have a great team that's working on it.
I don't know if you guys saw the story that I did a few weeks ago, but apparently everyone talks about why did Groupon go public so early. It was clearly a disastrous mistake in hindsight. Oliver Sommer.
Yep.
Banging the table, yelling they had to go public immediately.
Yeah.
Guy you want in your company. All right, we're going to go to questions in 5 minutes. So if some people want to line up at the mics, that would be great. I brought up Pinterest.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you guys see from Pinterest. I mean, I imagine there are a lot of things being pinned from Fab.
Absolutely.
I've heard a lot of mixed things from e-tailers. I've heard some people think it's a great way to get, you know, potential new customers. I've heard others say that, you know, the people who are pinning things, are it's this aspirational ideal of, you know, your self-image. It's not actually stuff you intend to buy. So does it impact your business yet?
So first of all, we admire them a lot. We think they're very innovative. I definitely subscribe to the view of, you know, thou shalt not talk ill of another fast-growing startup that is doing good things and innovating well. So I'm not going to sit here and talk bad about them. But the one thing is, I think it's still very unproven. And I think, you know, Facebook for us is a proven, you know, kind of source of high-quality traffic. Twitter for us is a proven source of high-quality traffic. Pinterest grew from about 0% to 2% of our traffic between August and January, and it's still at 2% today. And so it hasn't grown further than 2%. And we don't find that it necessarily converts as well as some other sources to purchases. So it's a lot of browsing and pinning, but not necessarily people that end up buying. But we're still at it, trying stuff, and we'd love to see them succeed. Like, we take the approach of, you know, when people browse, discover products in the offline world, they look at lots of different magazines and talks to lots of different people, and we want to work with as many people as possible. And so we hope Pinterest is successful as a way for people to discover products on Fab. And we just, a couple weeks ago, further integrated Pinterest into Fab to try to do even more with them. And, you know, we hope they figure it out. And, you know, I mean, they just raised $100 million, so hopefully they'll put all that to good use and figure out a lot.
How much money have you guys raised?
Oh, we've raised about $50 million.
And how far does that get you? You said you're not focused on profit margins. Does that mean you need to raise $50 million more?
You know, we have lots of people who want to invest in Fab. Financing the business is definitely not a concern of ours. You know, we're very focused on just making people smile every day. How's that for not answering your question? I'll tell you this. It is quite possible to run a business based on emotions while still running it as a business, is what we're doing. And we're dead set on having our U.S. business profitable next year and our European business profitable the following year.
It's pretty quick.
But if it also turns out that the right thing to do for the long term is to put that out a year or two, we'll do that too.
All right. Questions, anyone? Okay.
So I can appreciate that product is king, and that's a big focus of yours. But beyond that, how have you guys focused on customer acquisition from the beginning, and how has it evolved to now?
Yeah, so we definitely took the approach of a combination of social and highly targeted paid acquisition, and leading with social first. So we built social features, and it's kind of our it's part of our core DNA is kind of that, you know, part of, like, I think where a lot of companies get social wrong is by adding kind of, I call it the NASCAR kind of selection of kind of like buttons and share buttons as kind of an afterthought. And we kind of built social into the core Fab experience. That part of, you know, Bradford always says, you know, like, there's museums in every city of the world dedicated to design, so people love looking at design products. So we build part of Fab experience itself is getting inspired by design and sharing that with your friends and discovering design through your friends. And we've just always been part of the core experience. And then in terms of paid acquisition, you know, we're data junkies when it comes to that. We focus entirely on, you know, how quickly people, when they join Fab, convert to a purchase. How quickly they can convert to a second purchase. We know that once someone purchases twice on Fab, as I said, they're very likely to purchase six times within a period of, very short period of time. We're constantly looking at kind of payback periods of our cohorts, all this kind of stuff. But the key thing from a targeting perspective is we seeded our audience with people who we were highly confident would appreciate design. So our initial launch strategy, before we even launched the website, we got to 175,000 members before we even launched, through 2.5 months of both social and paid targeting of people who liked design blogs, who liked certain shopping brands, certain designers, and they helped build the audience for us.
Just as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we are hosting Fab.com, the design darling of e-commerce, with co-founders Jason Goldberg, CEO, and the muse Bradford Shellhammer, Chief Design Officer. I'm Sarah Lacey, the founder and editor-chief of Pando Daily, and let's continue with audience questions.
I'm curious how you guys came up with Make People Smile Every Day.
We were writing down on a napkin 7 core values of Fab about, I don't know. Sorry.
It's a
German thing.
Inside joke. Germans do this when they're thinking.
We have 100 people in Berlin.
So they always do this.
So you're ripping that off the
right. Yeah. But, sorry. So we built these 7 core principles, and Bradford and I were sitting around his desk, and we were writing them, and we had the 6th one, and one about our customers, one about our employees, and one about, and then we just need something that is like, just says it all. And Bradford said, "Smile, you're designed to," and it just kind of makes sense because you're designed to smile.
Yeah, and it was because we had gotten through these we wanted 7 things. I don't know why we wanted to make a list of 7 things, and we got 6, and we hit everything, and then it was kind of heavy. Like they were all kind of big and important, and then the idea was just, we're just selling chairs. It's like, lighten up. And so. Mm-hmm.
And everyone takes themselves way too seriously, especially in the tech community. And it's like, come on, really?
But it's a great thing. It's a great story about how we work is that most of the things that we do, the strategy of the company, every major decision of the company has happened either over a dinner table or a plane ride when we're sitting next to one another. And it really comes down to just 2 old friends that talk very casually. And that casual, I think, banter reflects in kind of the output that we put into the world as
Fab.
You guys
are flying to Europe tonight, are you not?
Tomorrow morning.
Oh, what big decisions are going to happen on that plane ride?
You'll hear about them next week, maybe.
All right, go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering, what's the key for your user experience process for building up the site? What types of things are you guys thinking about?
So, Bradford and I are both product guys. Bradford focuses on the physical product, and I focus on the virtual product. We have some kind of, basically every pixel that's on our website and app I've looked at, just like Bradford looks at every physical product. But I actually say at this point I probably have more control over the virtual product than Bradford today has over the physical, because we need a lot more people to do that part because there's so many SKUs on our site every day. But our philosophy, it's funny, our philosophy for web design is very similar to what Bradford would say is the philosophy for kind of the design of the products on our site is we just get out of the way and keep it simple. And for us, kind of a clean user experience is one that you don't need to tell the user how to do anything. They just can figure it out on their own.
Get out of the way was not our quote, by the way. Ava Zeisel said that.
Yeah.
who died this year, last year, and whose products we've sold. But, Jason's a master at doing what he does. And, the get out of the way thing was, like I said, I remember saying early on, I think I forwarded you via email, I said, Ava Zeisel said good design is just getting out of the way.
Yeah.
And I'm like, as long as you deliver on that, whatever the experience is, it's going to be a rich one.
And I think for me, I had a great learning experience. In 2009, I was the chief product officer of a company called Zing, which is like the LinkedIn of Europe. And it was in Germany, and we keep coming back to Germany, but I had one of the smartest teams of product managers I'd ever met. And one of the challenges I had is that in the German culture is all about being very, very instructive. And so they always want to put more words on the screen. And I set this rule. I said, no words. And they said, how could you do this without any words? You need to tell people instructions. And I said, that's your challenge. If people can't figure it out, then we're not building a good product.
Hi. I know starting a startup is always the hardest, and you guys, you know, done a really phenomenal job in the first couple of months. Can you speak to more of kind of what was going on within the company within that first 3 to 6 months? You know, it being able to get that 170,000 users to sign up before launch.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I'll talk about real briefly about what happened pre-launch and post-launch because there's two very different phases. So when we decided to shut down our old website, it was March 9th of last year, and we gave ourselves 3 months. To launch the new one, and we hit the date. We launched on June 9th. And during those 3 months, we basically split up the duties where Bradford focused on getting all the supply, and I focused on building the demand and building the technology. And we started basically with, it was just, you know, some developers who I've worked with for a number of years, or co-founders of our company, and Bradford and myself, and we had to build a team. And the initial team we built was basically, we said, you know, we need people over time in each of the following functions. So we're going to start off by hiring one person for each of those functions, knowing that we probably over time would need, like, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 people in each function. And every day it was all about what do we need to do in order to launch? What do we need to do in order to launch? But we also, we didn't say we're going to launch as quickly as possible. We said we're going to launch on this date, and we're going to make sure we're ready by that date. And there were certain things that had to be done. One key thing we said is we as we built up the audience, so we hit 50,000 members about 3 weeks after we shut down the old website, which is like, so we had people signing up just basically, they come to a splash page and said, Fab will feature design inspirations every day, and people were signing up and telling their friends about it, and they said, oh, nothing like this ever existed. They got excited about it. And when we hit 50,000 members, I kind of had my first, like, oh, shit moment, where I was like, you know, it's like, it was like April 15th, and, you know, people by June are forget about us. And so we very quickly cobbled together some social features for people to play with on the site long before we launched the actual sales themselves a couple months later. So we launched what we called our inspiration wall, where people could upload design inspiration photos and tag them across the web. And that really is when things really took off virally. So then that helped us get to 175,000 members waiting by launch time. Once we launched, it was a whole different ballgame. So actually, my biggest fear 2 days before launch was that we would sell too much. And it was really this weird feeling. We had 175,000 people. Bradford had done this amazing job of lining up the most incredible designers to be featured on the site in the first week. And my worry was, like, that wheels were just going to fall off the cart if we sold too much. And we, you know, thankfully, we prepared for that. But we sold $65,000 worth of product in our first day, and more than that on the second day and third day and the fourth day. And it was like, you see the orders coming in, and you're like, oh my God, someone's got to actually get this to someone, right? That was like a real kind of eye-opening experience that, like, all right, so yeah, you launched a website, but now you got to sell, you know, you actually got to deliver the product. And I would say that the biggest shift in focus that we had in the beginning was, you know, so we launched June 9th. Things kept rolling, you know, June, July. We realized at the end of July that we couldn't keep growing at the rate we were growing without having problems. And we basically, in August, we took a month where we said, look, we're still going to grow, but we're not going to allow ourselves to grow on purpose. It would be organic. Not allow ourselves to kind of grow on purpose until we had a kind of a month where we just solidified the operations. And we basically said August was the month where we just stable. And it was like, and that was a very key moment in our company's history. We basically went from about 20 full-time employees to about 50 full-time employees, just getting people in key roles and saying, we can't add more sales until we have more of these types of people. We can't fulfill more product until we have these more people. We need experts who know how to do this, this, and this. And if we hadn't done that, we would have had a lot of problems. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. We only have 5 minutes left. Can each of you go really quickly? Okay.
Well, it's up to me. I'm always the one who talks too much.
You and me both.
So does Fab attract product manufacturers who take great photographs, or do they take great pictures because of Fab?
Both. You know, this was one thing early on that I think clearly made us stand out from other e-commerce players who reshot almost everything in their way. Mm-hmm. And our whole philosophy is that the products stand on their own, and that a well-designed product can live next to any other well-designed product, regardless of color, material, even style. And almost exclusively, we use vendor-supplied photography because the hunch is, that's been proven right, I think, that over the past year, is that the people who make the product and are most intimate with it also are the best people to style it and shoot it. That's 95% of the time. You know, it's vendor-supplied photos, and they're really good. The other 5%, they're not really good. And it's gotten to the point now where if we really love the product and the brand's not capable of shooting it, we'll take it in and shoot it in our photo studio. But more and more now we're training, you know, the designers. You know, this is part of the whole thing. It's about empowering designers to actually think differently about their businesses and not just make jewelry, but think about how to sell and market their jewelry and present it and get more retail accounts from being on Fab. We're now pushing it back on them even more and saying, we have a document that says this is the best way to shoot this, this is the best way to shoot this, this is the best way to shoot mm-hmm. this. And so more and more they're shooting it themselves. Mm-hmm.
Last one.
I totally appreciate that you're the muse because I'm the crazy muse in our group. And you make me look totally...
I
keep talking and I go, I love him. I totally relate to him.
So you're crazy.
I'm the Lucille Ball. I'm totally nuts. But my question is about inventory and about price point. Do you drop ship all your product or have you actually purchased your product? And as far as price points are concerned, you know, you offer a discount. Is that a discount that you get from the manufacturer, or is that a discount that you just offer and take it off
of
your end
product? I'll give a really quick answer to this because we've got, like, no seconds left.
Okay, go ahead.
So we – 5 seconds? We're fine?
Go ahead.
When we started off, it was 100% dropship because it was the path of least resistance. On day one, we did $65,000 in sales, and everyone said, I can't dropship that many orders. Yeah. And so
– we went to Milton Glaser's office, and he designed I Heart New York. I don't know if everyone knows him, but you know, the most famous graphic designer in the world. And he's like, sure, you could. He was thinking we'd sell 10 of his posters. We sold like 400. He's like, you guys, we can't. We like went over and picked them up and brought them back to our office and rolled them up in our office and sent them out.
But so today, about 75% of all product goes through Fab's warehouse. A large part of the product is increasingly stuff that we are taking inventory of long before the sales. We're moving more towards that model increasingly. We're also making product that's being made with designers especially for Fab. And in terms of discounting, we always make sure that, first of all, we like to give our customers a discount when we can, but price isn't the motivating factor for our sales. We always like to make sure that the designer's making money, Fab's making money, and the customer is getting the best price available on the internet during the sale.
But are you buying off price is what I'm asking.
Yeah, is that coming out of their end or your end?
This is where it's different than, say, the Groupon. You know, the best retail accounts get a discount off of wholesale. So baked into the wholesale cost, if you're like a mom-and-pop shop in Minneapolis and I'm a tabletop brand, you're buying, you know, a couple boxes worth of my product, you're not one of my key accounts. It's great, but you're buying things at retail. If you're Neiman Marcus and you're buying pallets of products and you're a considerable amount of the revenue, you know, there's 10, 15, 20% that's baked into retail that retailers offer to their key retail partners. So what we're doing is that, you know, we may not have been around as some of these brands that are big, but we're delivering the results as big as some of these big retail accounts. So we're not asking for more than what you know any other kind of important retail partner would get. From
We've never market. Asked for more than someone's. You know.
So the discount is legitimate. It's not built. In other words, it's not coming off of your end.
Oh, it's not a Pets.com. It's not two bags of cat foods to hook you as a customer.
No, absolutely not. No, we don't knowingly lose money on sales. No.
Knowingly, unless it's yarn tax.
I mean, that's not the intent. Yeah.
Well, some things have cost a little more to ship than we may have thought, but
knowingly.
But
we always try to make sure that if it's going to be sustainable long term, it's got to be that everyone wins.
Yeah.
Right? The customer's got to feel good, the partner's got to feel good, and Fab's got to do well over
time.
And
the great thing we've experienced recently is that we can sell full price products. We had there's a brand called Areaware. I don't know if anyone knows that, but they're a pretty unique Brooklyn based design company, and they make everything from, you know, ashtrays to wall clocks to, but it's a really cool mix of product. And, you know, they have stuff that we can buy at a deeper discount because it's excess inventory. And then they have their kind of greatest hits. And we did two sales on the same day of kind of discounted area wear product and full price area wear product. And 8-to-1, we sold more units of the full price product than the discounted product. And some of the discount was substantial. And it had everything to do with this is the better product.
Question. So, discounted.
None of this has been quick.
Just
we
quick.
We really should just bring out some drinks for everybody.
I know. I need it all night, right?
So, you just feel that the
I'm only letting you go because I was 30 minutes late.
I'm sorry, say it again?
In other words, price doesn't make a difference if it's a desirable product. Price. Discount doesn't sell it. It's the uniqueness
it's
of the product.
It's the product. We could put dollar beige boring sheets.
I've lost control. On the I think we've already covered this.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. We're done.
So, two last things. So, first of all, and I want this in like two words, Bradford.
We're loquacious. Gregarious.
So, if your house was on fire, what would be the one thing you would grab?
Oh, my God. My passport.
That's not even good design.
Because it allows me to leave. That's what I would grab.
All right. Now, here at Inforum.
It has a great product. It has a great passport cover.
What color is it? It's bright, I bet.
It's black.
You're Mr. Color.
No, stop.
I'm buying you a new one.
I'm getting old.
They didn't make it in yellow. You tried to get it.
Yeah, I tried to get it in yellow, but they said, we only make it in black. But the design itself, I was like, this is the perfect size. I need this, and I bought it. But anyway, sorry.
Here at Inforum, we like to end all of our events by asking our speakers the following question. Jason and Bradford. We don't always ask it that far. Jason and Bradford, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world?
Just make people smile and bring more color into their life.
I feel I've heard that. Bradford?
Laugh. Like, smile. It comes down to have fun. I mean, it's all the same. We package it in a bunch of different ways, but we're basically saying the same thing. Don't take yourself too seriously and do good in the world.
But be authentic about it. Like, you can't fake it. It's got to be real.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do I need to bang the gavel? Okay. We also, there's a VIP reception. I was told to tell the VIPs. I mean, I think you're all VIPs. It's really the Commonwealth Club that's drawing lines here.
It's so not bad to have VIP. Everyone's VIP on Fab.
It's not Panda either. Our events are $20. They're cheap. They're never inviting me back. Is it that way?
To the left.
It's to the left. Just the VIPs. All right. This concludes our meeting. Do you want to do the gavel this time?
It's all you, please. I don't have that kind of power.
Thank you. Thank you.